So Lawrence is going to introduce our next presenter. Do you want to?
Thank you, Dan. Our next guest, Bob Smith, has a BSEE from the University of Washington. He's worked in the biomedical industry for over 45 years. The last 20 or more years, he's spent developing acoustic research and audio engineering disciplines for Stryker Physiocontrol, formerly Medtronic, to improve speech intelligibility for medical device voice prompting and voice recording systems in noisy environments. When he's not playing acoustic audio monkey for his corporate master, he runs an acoustic lab, SoundSmith Labs. From time to time, he can also be found recording local musical talents. Currently, he's comparing audio measurement systems to assess how much they vary and the degree they converge on similar results. Welcome, Bob Smith.
Thank you. Am I live now?
Yep.
Okay. Good evening. And I'm going to take on part two here. In part one, JJ described the problem of the discontinuities created by differences between sampled signals and FFT size and how they may be addressed by FFT window functions. In this part, I hope to briefly review typical audio measurement tools that utilize these analysis and window functions. And where in the analyzers this particular adjustment of the parameter exists. We're going to take a single measurement and repeat it with multiple windows to see how the same measurement looks different. It's going to be somewhat of a repeat of what JJ's done, but it's going to be from the point of view of an actual measurement using an actual measurement system. And then finally, we'll look at a couple of examples of measurement situations and which window fits which situation. So that's our overview. Here's an example of systems that I work with for making measurements. The top one, we've got an Audio Precision APX 555. And all three of these systems that we're talking about here require a laptop to do the analysis presentation and some of the post-analysis. So the APX 555 comes with proprietary software to get that job done, and you add that to your laptop, and you've got a system. I have a Prism Sound D-Scope personally, and again, with its proprietary software, you in a laptop, you get the system complete. What I'm using tonight that we're going to give the demonstrations on is a more of a do-it-yourself system. It's made up of a RME ADI-2 Pro and a software analysis tool called HPWWorks. Now, one of the things that the first two analyzers do is they have all the calibrations. They have a whole pile of functions, many of which go into some esoteric measurement situations. But for just doing the common, ordinary, everyday harmonic distortion, total harmonic distortion plus noise, you can get by with an audio interface in HPWWorks. But you have to do your own calibration. You've got to have a digital multimeter and figure out what level of signal you're putting out, what level of signal you're bringing back. One of the reasons I like this particular device from RME, they kind of understand the situation and will give you calibrated outputs. You can set this thing for plus 4 dBU, plus 13 dBU, plus 19 dBU, plus 24 dBU for the output, and the same for inputs. And having checked them, it's doing what it says within something like 0.01 dB. So it's not a bad substitute for tonight's work. So let's have a look at a typical measurement system architecture. Now, I lifted this one from The Fundamentals of Modern Audio Measurement, which was written by Richard C. Cabot, who was at the time part of Audio Precision. And it was published in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society, September 1999. So if you have that issue, you've got a very fine reference for measurements and measurement systems. If you don't have it, you can still get the article in a PDF format, and it's well worth having on your shelf. Now, the point of this diagram here is to look at the complexity of the system. And we're going to be talking about one specific parameter that exists inside of this entire complex system, and it's right there in the red block, the DSP block. But before I go on, I just want to point out, for people who have to do measurements on a regular basis, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of parameters that need to be adjusted. You've got to get them all correct to come up with a quality measurement. Otherwise, at the least, you're going to come up with a less than optimal measurement. At the worst, you're going to come up and fool yourself. In this measurement architecture, too, I also like to point out that the signal generator, the stimulus, is on the left-hand side of the architecture diagram, and the measurement system is on the right-hand side. We're going to see that theme repeated here.
Bob?
Yes.
All of these things are relatively similar in SMART and whatever other...
There are principles that are the same, but they also have some very different features they could do. For instance, SMART, you don't do jitter measurements. You don't do eye pattern measurements. There's a whole bunch of things you're not going to do with SMART. But then again, it's probably not the best choice to pick an APX555 to go do live sound measurements. So they all have FFT analysis systems in them, but they've been optimized to do different things. And some are optimized more for real time. If I'm sitting here and I cut loose with a 1 million point transform in here, we'll go out, take a break, and come back, and a half an hour later it might be done. Maybe a 16 million point would take that long. 1 million point probably will only take us a couple of minutes. So they're optimized for different things, but they're based on the same principles that JJ was talking about. In the HPW works that I'm going to use tonight, we've got a simplified architecture here, taking in all that stuff that was on the left in the previous diagram and bringing it down to a single block. We'll call it the stimulus. And the reddish-yellow block is our device under test. Those of us in the measurement business call it the DUT all the time, but that it's the device we're testing. And then on the right-hand side is our measurement system. And again, the particular parameter, the window function, exists in that right-hand most upper block called the FFT and spectrum block. Moving on, here's the more complex version of the very same simplified diagram. You can see we've got a few more blocks in there. I don't know how well you can see all those blocks. Let's see if I can get over here. This block right up here is our A to D, D to A. This is our physical I/O. And now we've moved on into the system itself. And in here we've got the acquisition for getting the buffer, however many points in that transform we want to acquire. We've got our input calibration for making this so we know in a calibrated fashion where we're talking about in our measurements. We might want to apply, there's a block up here where we can apply some math, like maybe put a weighting function. You probably have heard of A weighting, C weighting. A lot of people like to use A-weighted noise measurements because they throw away a lot of the low frequencies and get to hide a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Only for things at threshold.
Yeah, it gets used a lot. Misused a lot would be a better way of saying it. But our little block where we're going to be playing with is, right here. This little block right here is where we're going to be making adjustments in the FFT window and FFT calculation. Now, I'd like to point out that when I do the demonstrations, there's no amplifier here. I've got some canned demonstrations, but I am making calibrated measurements tonight. This device has been set for a reference of plus 19 dBU, and all the features have been turned off inside. There's no EQ. There's no fancy anything being done, but I am running a digital gain of minus 29 dBFS. That conveniently puts us at minus 10 dBU, or 245 millivolts. That's a very convenient voltage for making a lot of measurements, preamp measurements, amplifier measurements in the first watt range, headphone amplifier measurements, the measurements of these kind of devices. It's a really convenient voltage to be at. So, I circled the block that shows you where we're going to be, so I didn't have to do it manually. All right. From the fundamentals of modern audio measurement, here's a sentiment I really like. JJ stated this. I'm saying again. You got a lot of papers out there on it, so you have about as many window functions as there are papers. And from a practical viewpoint, we probably use lesson six on a regular basis. If we have an esoteric problem and we really need to hone in on it, we might have a very specific window function we might want to try to help us with that problem. But for the most part, it's rectangular, Hahn, Blackman, Harris. And we're going to see why that is. This is what stimulated me to even ask JJ to do this his portion of the presentation, and for me to kind of expand my own knowledge on why we choose which ones. I get this HPW Works, and just like every one of the other analyzers, I come to a page like this. It's a setup page for this particular parameter. You see, there's all kinds of things to set up in there, but here's this one, and I got 39 windows here. What do I need 39 windows for? Why would I want to choose all of them? And you'll see quite a few of them that JJ mentioned already. The Backman-Nuttall, the Hamming. In here, they've got it incorrectly called Hanning. A lot of these folks put it in there that way, but it's Dr. von Hahn. And this is what motivated doing this topic tonight.
I will note something about that. Go back to that list for a second.
Yes.
It says rectangular
none. Uh-huh. Yes.
And that's just, shouldn't say none there. They should say, you don't have a choice of none unless you do an infinite transform.
Yeah.
There is essentially, the act of windowing is taking an infinite amount of data and selecting a finite chunk of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine that what you're doing to all the rest of the samples that you didn't select, you multiplied them by zero. Mm-hmm. And there you get your rectangular window.
Yep.
So, we're going to leave it academics behind now, and we're going to go into the practical application because these are the guys like me, the poor schmuck who actually has to get this job done on a daily basis. And we're trying to figure out which of these things do I pick and why, and what kind of results can I expect from that. So let's get an orientation on a window that we might be looking at when we are doing our measurement. Typical XY axis. On the Y axis, we've got DBU. This is calibrated DBU. That 10 DBU at the top, minus 10 DBU at the top, is 245 millivolts RMS. And we'll be going a span of 160 DBU down the Y axis. There we go, down the Y axis. We're in linear frequency on the X axis only because it makes more sense for tonight's purposes. Normally, I'm looking at logarithmic for most of my measurements, but tonight, to demonstrate some of these things, we're using a linear axis. We're spanning about 1,000 hertz because we're going to conveniently pick a 500 hertz signal. I don't like 1,000 hertz for a signal stimulus. It hurts my ears. I know it makes engineers happy, but if you actually pop open a speaker accidentally when you're listening to it, it's annoying. We're going to average a little bit tonight. Averaging is just a simplified, oversimplified discussion here. We use averaging to help smooth out the sides as we look into the far field. We reduce the random noise in the bins that we display. And I'm going to be using an average of 4. I'm picking an FFT size of 32,768 for tonight's purposes. Often I'll use something higher, but again, there's trade-offs to be had there. And down here in the lower right-hand corner, where's my mouse? There we go. We have a sample rate of 48 kilohertz. So that's to orient you to what we're going to see. This really goes pretty quickly once we get going. So here, I'm going to leave this particular presentation and bring up the live thing. So bear with me while I switch modes. And let's see, what I really want. Duplicate of this displays. Okay, apply that. Where's my mouse? Yeah, I know you're going to go away in a minute. There we go. And that. All right. Here is a live analyzer set up in front of you. On this big right block here, that's our signal generator. And I've preset it for 500 hertz. And I've not done anything special to it. It's 500 hertz. We've got our master control in this block, and here's our display. And to begin with, let's make sure that we have a rectangular window selected. So here we are. We've got all these different parameters that we can set up in this system. Just to give you a brief idea of it, you've got a lot of things to make sure that you get right. And in particular, we want to start with a rectangular window. And let's run an FFT with 500 hertz as a stimulus. And first off, all we're getting is noise because I forgot to turn the signal generator on. Like I say, it doesn't take much to make it go wrong. Hey, this looks familiar. This looks just like what JJ showed. And you can see it's got a very narrow peak to it and rolls off. Oop, now we did it. Okay, get back to the... There we go. Roll off into the far field, and we're only down about 70 dB. Okay, if we were looking at things that had some distortion noise and was down only 30 or 40 dB, this would work all right. We'd be okay. We'd get there. But if we're looking for things that are 80, 90, 100 dB down, we're never going to see them with this setup. So maybe we might want to try one of those other windows. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in and, just for fun, we're going to pick a Hamming window, just so you can see what it looks like in comparison. Oh, and let me store this so we keep these around for being able to ABX compare them. Rectangular, there we go. Okay, we've got it stored. Now we try our Hamming window. Hey, we got a little improvement there. We're down another almost 20 dB. So that's kind of nice. JJ, why does it do this little, right as we come off the peak, there's this little dip and then another secondary peak?
It's because don't forget, the Hamming window doesn't go to zero.
Uh-huh.
So depending on the actual signal going in, you may see some effects due to the derivative of the signal at the end. So sometimes that will show up, sometimes that won't.
Okay. But it makes for a nice display here.
It makes for a nice display, and why you might not want to use that window.
Exactly.
To me, I think it's just the initial side loads, but neighboring side loads.
But you'll find with a Hamming window, since it doesn't treat all samples identically, you find that it actually will have different side loads with different signals, which is annoying.
So now we're going to pick on JJ's favorite here. We're going to pick a Hahn window and repeat the measurement. Oh, look at that. Wow, we came down much more rapidly and got to a much lower level. We're down at minus 130 dB. We're 120 dB below our signal at this point. But let me store this and then point out something that's kind of interesting here. There's these two little spikes right here. They're indicative that there might be something more here to be seen than what we're actually seeing using this particular window. So let me change the window again, and we're going to pick a Blackman-Harris 7-term and repeat the measurement. Oh, there are two spurs there at 450 and 550 hertz. I knew they were going to be there because I put them in the signal generator. At 100 dB below the signal. So, yes, this would be indicative of a jitter. If I was looking for a jitter signal, the Blackman-Harris might be better for this particular measurement than the Hahn, and certainly better than the rectangular. But now, let's imagine that we have control of both the signal generator and the measurement system with a single clock, and we do. Did I save this? Do we have all three on there? No, we don't have the Blackman-Harris on there yet. Let me save that. Okay. Seven term, there we go. All right. Now we do have control of the clock that's our stimulus as well as the clock that's our measurement system, and we have the ability to do something with our signal generator that JJ alluded to earlier. We could change up our signal. This is our signal generation table here. And you can see where I've got the 550 and the 450 hertz in there. You also see that that's the frequency I asked for. Then it shows a thing called the real frequency. Now, why would they do that? Because they've got this nice little feature down here called coherent frequency. When I punch that feature, it adjusts the signal source that I'm using ever so slightly. My 500 hertz became 499.51. My constructed spur, 100 dB down, is now 549.32 instead of 550. When I do that, and I get the system running again so I don't forget, and now let me go back and change back to a rectangular window and watch what is going to happen. Oh my goodness, it got even narrower. We didn't get this high side lobe far field there. We got something way down noise. But nothing comes free. This sounds like some really neat stuff. I want to show you what happens when we expand the x-axis here and show you some of the trade-offs that are existing here. Let's see. I need to change the scales. We're going to go to 440 hertz and 560, I think. Well, that should do it. Okay, now we got to zoom in, and earlier JJ was talking about how wide the main lobe was in the various versus the various window functions. And we see with the let me go ahead and take some of these things off. Let's go back and step through this. The rectangular as it was. Notice how sharp that is at the top there with the rectangular window, and how it remains sharp when we went to our coherent measurement system. And now let's bring some of those back one at a time. Let's bring the Hamming back. Okay. All right. When we got our drop in our far field so we could see signals better out there, it widened out the main lobe. And that's really what all these trade-offs between all the windows is. How wide is this going to be? How much of a peak are you going to get? How much far field rejection are you going to get? So let me bring them all a couple more back. The Hahn and the Blackman-Harris. Okay. And you can see when I got to the Blackman-Harris, which gave me a really nice view far field here for the spurs, I got quite a wide main lobe in exchange. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. In JJ's 17th slide, he said, you need to know what you're measuring, and you need to know what it is you hope to get from that measurement. Is that right? And that is the gist of why you have all these windows and what you choose. But now, we looked at this magic one and said, hey, what if I made the signal coherent with the measurement system? I get this amazing spike in the center and amazing spurs on the side that only works when we do have a coherent system. The signal, there's one clock, and it also only works if we don't have other signals present, either noise or spurs, that start to get within the same region of level as our main signal, because we're going to get that discontinuity back. And once we get the discontinuity back, we're going to pop right back up to this green line or this yellow line and get a noisy measurement once again. So there's another way we can skin this cat. We can say, hey, look, what if I go back here to a system that is not coherently synchronized. I'm going to stop. Yeah, I got to stop this first. My multitasking kind of goes downhill this time of the evening. And we're going to go back to a 500 hertz exactly. We're going to change our back to a Hahn window here. I want a Hahn window. There we go. But I'm going to now increase the FFT size. I'm going to set that up for, say, let's go for 262. That ought to do it. Get that running. And let's take another measurement. Now, you notice it's not reacting to me right away. Oh, it took a while to get the first one up. And that's because I'm using a lot more points. It takes a little bit longer for the FFT to be acquired and then computed. And so here you can see this was another way for me to get a narrower peak and a steep side lobe here. Far field goes down. But now the trade-off here is a bigger FFT. It took longer. If I'm just doing this one or two times in prototype and I'm really interested in getting a specific answer, this probably doesn't matter to me. But if I'm on the production line and I got to make this measurement and I got to pass these guys by and I've got maybe 20 measurements to do and I've been given a budget of 2 minutes to get them all done, well, I've just blown most of it right on this one measurement. So this is why you need to know what it is you're measuring, what the purpose is for that measurement, how you want to get it done, and the trade-offs between averaging, FFT size, windows. So with that, I'm going to go back and kind of recap, and then we will finish up with some example situations. To do that, we've got to go back to extending the displays. All right. Yep. There we go. PowerPoint back. And you'll notice that in case the demo didn't work, I had this all mapped out in advance. you know how that goes. Demos sometimes fall apart on you right in the middle. Just again, the asynchronous versus a coherent signal stimulation, the ability to use the rectangular window by nudging the frequency just ever so slightly, our stimulus from 500 to 499.51. And we got some amazing results out of that. So, once again.
Just to clarify.
Yes. So if you were, let's say you were making a loop to be played in your wavetable in your synthesizer, and you didn't bring it back so it matched to zero, what are you going to hear at the end as it makes the loop? Yep. And that same pop causes us great grief when we do the FFT. So what we're doing is we're trying to get so it's a now a loopable signal that fits within size our to the end samples that we're doing for our FFT. So, question here.
How likely is it in real life do you have situations where you can control the input so that it...
Ah, well, good point. We'll get to that. Okay. It's coming up, but that's a good point. Yes?
Doesn't that seem like if you synchronously average, you start going from zero, starting, stopping, doesn't that obviate a lot of the problems that you talked about if you could control it so well? Plus, synchronously averaging, each time you double the number of averages, don't you improve the signal-to-noise ratio? Meaning, isn't that a better approach?
When you can use it.
Get away with it.
When you can get away with it. If I have another signal that might be only 20 dB down, 30 hertz away, then suddenly maybe that's not going to work so well.
You could increase the number of averages.
But again, it depends on what you're trying to do and how much is your time budget. Your bin noise residual, your bin.
3 dB. Yeah, 3 dB, so that's not bad.
Your bin residual noise goes down, but that doesn't necessarily give you an improvement on another signal adjacent. It's just your bin noise is going down.
It doesn't give you extra resolution, but it improves your signal to noise,
right? But again, here was the example. I actually mapped it out here. That one million point FFT, if I were to run on here, takes 22 seconds per measurement. And if I need to average it four times to get the bin noise down, that's 88 seconds. If I've got 2 minute time budget to get 20 measurements done on a particular thing, I've blown my time budget. So again, it's all trade-offs. And that's why I'm bringing these up, the real world examples of, you see a particular approach here and wow, that looks like that's the one I should use. You should use that all the time. That's not true. Slide 17 on JJ's. Pay attention to it. So I like this particular Siegel's Law because it's so apropos to our situation. We've only got a few slides left and we're done. Here is the asynchronous stimulus examples. Why we got to have a window, especially if we have a signal generator that is separate and not synchronized in any way, fashion, shape, or form with our measurement tool, and we've got something in between we're going to measure, and our device under test here. You see we've got clock one and clock two, and there's no guarantees these guys are synchronized at all, so we definitely need a window, and a good place to start is a Hahn or a Blackman Harris 7, depending upon what you need for adjacent spur detection. And for those of you who are fond of such things, that's a 274B rectifier tube there, and those are two 6SN7s. This is an exotic headphone amplifier. Again, here's another asynchronous stimulus example. We don't even have, we have to, in advance, create a WAV file that represents the stimulus that we want to use, or the stimuli plural, and put them in these little portable listening devices that we might be testing. And so they've got a clock inside, and we certainly aren't going to have any ability to get in there and muck with that. So we definitely have to, once again, concern ourselves with those windows. Here's the situation. We've got an APX555 or a Prism Sound. We've got the source, and we've got the measurement system. We've got them all under the same clock. And we know that the interfering signals are going to be down enough that they're not going to produce that point of discontinuity. And this is our device, another headphone amplifier, being measured in between. In the red here, the device under test, then we can use a rectangular window, go to the coherent measurement technique, and we're likely to get a pretty good result there. But we got a lot of ands that you got to. Here we go. You've got a lot of ands you got to satisfy. So. I don't think so. I've got an HP 339, and I tried getting it close. I've never come up with any good results with it other than when I sit there and nudge it, I can sometimes watch in the rectangular window. I can watch the sides go drop drastically when I get real close. But true to life, the temperature changes or time goes by a little bit, and it drifts right out. So, that's the practical part. Questions?
This is for both you and JJ. What have you got against the Kaiser window?
If it's what you need.
It just seems to be, I mean, the real thing about, you didn't say this, JJ, but the real thing about the Kaiser window is it has a parameter in there that we have to trade off, and we can make the main lobe narrower at the expense of bringing up the crap on the sides, or we could bring the crap down on the sides down, but that has the at the expense of making the main lobe wider.
And there are a number of those.
Yeah, there's a lot, but I mean, just saying, that's the one that's kind of been optimized to have the lowest side lobes for the same width of the main lobe.
So I'd answer you this way. This is the index on this particular tool.
Huh?
Oh, sorry. All right. Let's go over here. I'll do it this way, if I can see that. Yeah. All right. And now if I get over here.
Yeah, there's the big list.
Okay. And these people have taken the time to give you an overview, and a zoomed-in view so you can see the behavior. And they've got them, every one of them labeled of the 39 that they've employed, and you can go step through here and say, okay, what behavior do I wish to achieve? And as you step through them, pick the window function that fits the situation. These are very handy to have these already done for you. You don't have to make them yourself. These guys figured this out, that it's good to have in the index.
Is the graph on the left with a lot more points than the graph on the right? Because it's
no, it's the graph on the left, let's talk x-axis. Graph on the left, since I can't quite see it here, I need to pull it back. I should have extended the displays to do this. Let me pull it away from you for a moment. They're working at 62 kilohertz. But remember how when I had the graph out, we started out looking at 0 to 1,000 hertz, and then I blew it up to 440, 560. That's what we're doing here. We're zooming the y-axis.
So that's zoomed in on the right.
The right is the y. Okay. I'm sorry, the x-axis. Thank you. X-axis is zoomed. And they've made this handy index for you to go through and say, I see what situation I'm looking for, and apply that window. Question?
So let's say I want to make a simple tuner. Wouldn't it be better to just rectangular it, since I don't expect the user to use the tuner when the instrument is really far away? And I guess windowing also comes with the cost of multiplying your samples in the window with whatever the window function is.
What kind of a tuner are we talking about? A guitar tuner or an FM tuner?
Guitar tuner, sorry.
Uh-huh. What do you want to do with the tuner? You want it to tell you the frequency?
Mm-hmm. Pitch.
The pitch.
And I don't expect my peak to be at the noise level, since it's going to be close to the instrument. Since I don't expect my user.
Well, you can see from the windows we got here that if you don't expect anything above these lines here, yeah, you probably could get by without it. Yes.
So, the two extreme measurements that you'd be making, if you really have to know which one are you using, say, would be like if you were measuring harmonically related distortion artifacts, you could have a pretty broad window there. But if you were measuring jitter, then you'd want a very narrow.
Yes. Jitter is where we really are looking for stuff that's just real close in to our main lobe. But the harmonic distortion, you can get away with a lot with harmonic distortion. And then harmonic distortion plus noise is actually the easy one. All you got to do is notch out the main lobe, and whatever's left is your measurement. So, yeah.
So it's just a matter of frequency resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'll let JJ answer that one.
Would you like to rephrase that?
So I've heard about like sliding DFTs, where you have like you're adding new samples and then you're subtracting the one you're removing.
Well,
so
you're just moving a window,
real time
window. Yeah, that like one of the reasons I use a hand window is because if you shift the hand window by half the length, it will add to one between the add the one and all the samples in the middle.
You might slide by one sample.
Slide by one sample.
Yeah.
You can do that, but generally I don't usually have a use for that.
Probably you have to just apply the window after each slide.
You can. There are some regulations where
you unwindow, slide one sample, apply the window to the new data.
Yes, you can. You can do it by moving one and adding in the new B to the J omega and subtracting the old one out, repeating that. The difficulty when you do that is you'll build up numerical problems really fast.
Not to mention, it's rather computationally expensive to keep doing that over and over and over again.
And the thing is, you can keep all the basis factors stored in memory. The problem is that you have to keep, when you do that, you're going to start, when you do that, adding in the beginning, you subtract it, and keeping it running in total, you're going to start getting growth of noise really fast.
Okay.
Typically called the short time for the transform.
All right, last question.
Yeah, I just had a question about, you talked about average and an average of four. Could you expand on that? Is that just...
Oh, we just took an FFT, and then we took another FFT, and then another one. We averaged four FFT measurements together.
With overlap, or...?
No. We trigger, and we take and acquire a bunch of samples. Then we trigger again, hopefully at the exact same spot at the beginning of the stimulus's cycle, and do another average, and we repeat that. And each time we repeat that, let's see if I can get this back up on the display here.
I understand now, Bob. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm done.